First Peter chapter 4. First Peter chapter 4, beginning at the very beginning of the chapter, 1 Peter 4:1. Therefore, and we could spend all of today and much of probably many days simply on that single word. Peter has been laying a case for the faithfulness to the gospel, but let us go on. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude. Because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans chose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. But they will have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was preached even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to men in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the spirit. The end of all things is near. And you know that's true. Whether Jesus comes in the next 5 minutes or the next 5 years or the next 5 decades, it's true. Phil Donahue. Anybody still remember Phil Donahue? Phil Donahue interviewed Billy Graham one time when Billy Graham was having a crusade out in Las Vegas. And he, you know, I used to watch Phil Donahue, and seldom did people get it over on Phil, but boy, Billy Graham put him on his heels and set him back. And he started out and he goes, "Well, Billy, you've been saying that Jesus is coming back, but it's been a long time since you started preaching. What if he doesn't come back for another 100 years? And Billy said, "Well, Phil, that won't matter a whit to either one of us, because 100 years from now, both of us will be dead. And on the day you die is the end of the world for you." Is that not the truth? The end of all things is near. Therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. Today I want to talk about that last verse, verse 8. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. I find it interesting that in light of everything that Peter has been saying, the Holy Spirit inspired these words, above all. More important than that the end is near, more important than the drunkenness and carousing and the fact that you're not doing that, more important than arming yourself to suffer. And all of those things are things that the church teaches very little these days. Most of the church is about how Christianity can make your life easier and how you can have it all and you can succeed and just put a smile on your face and send in your $1,000 and God will be obligated. Jesus only promised one thing in this life, and that is suffering. But in the midst of all these important things, these things that are necessary if we are to experience experience genuine Christianity, the Holy Spirit says, above all. Above all. This is the first priority. And you know, it's one of those priorities that it's very easy to give lip service to, but very hard to practice. It is much easier to fill out a Bible study sheet and say, I've studied the Bible. It is much easier to join a ministry and donate hours of time. It is much easier to listen to sermons than it is to love one another. But Peter says, above all, this is of utmost importance. This is not a singular passage. Notice how John says it. Look with me in 1 John chapter 4. Easy to remember because they're the same verses. 1 Peter 4 and 1 John 4. 1 John 4, beginning at verse 7. 1 John 4, 7. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. I heard a story one time, and it's very fanciful, but I believe that it illustrates the issue that is the difference between heaven and hell. There was a story told that heaven, there is a giant table that is heaven. But everyone in heaven only has a 4-foot fork. So the only way that you can eat is if you feed the person across the table from you. And in heaven, a party's going on and everyone's eating and there is laughter and celebration. And in hell is the same table and the same food and the same fork. But no one celebrates and everyone eyes everyone warily and no one eats because no one will feed someone else. That is the attitude of Satan. Love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God because God is love. This is how God showed His love among us. He sent His one and only Son into the world that we might live through Him. This is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, there's the foundation. We ought to love one another. Since God loved us. How can I look at the love? I was talking with somebody this week, and they were complaining about a person, and they said, oh, but this person's constantly doing this. And I said, have you ever constantly done something to God? Think hard now. Actually, most of us, it doesn't take too much thinking hard, does it? Can you not point in your own life the things that you should have defeated years ago but live on in your life? Attitudes, behaviors. Maybe there are things that you don't even think people see, but even if no one sees it, God sees it. I remember an evangelist made a statement a number of years ago. He said, how is it that we would never dare to do some things in front of sinful human beings, but we will do them with utter abandon in front of holy God when He sees everything we do? What a convicting statement. And yet, how many times are there things that you've said, oh God, I never want to do this again. And yet you have done. And but for the grace of God, what would have been the consequences of that? how then can we turn around to someone else and say, but they did it to me 5 times. I would have forgiven them 3 times. I remember the old Western, and the parson comes into town, and he's not, I think he was played by Robert Mitchum, which if you know those old actors, was one of those old Hollywood tough guys. And he comes into town, and he's the new parson. And this guy, he goes into the saloon to preach in the saloon, and the one guy starts to mouth off to him and walks up to him, and he's harassing him, and finally just hauls off and belts him right across the mouth. Robert Mitchum just stands there. The guy turns, boom, on the other cheek, and Robert Mitchum decks him. And they go, "Parson, was that godly?" And he says, "Jesus told us to turn the other cheek. I just ran out of cheeks." You want a God who runs out of cheeks? Thank God, God doesn't run out of cheeks, does he? Who would raise their hand and say, "Oh, I've never had to presume upon God not running out of cheeks"? Certainly not me. Since God so loved us, we ought to love one another. Now, I want you to notice the word that Peter uses in this. Peter uses the word, he says, above all, love each other deeply. I remember when I was a young Christian, there was a person who had a bad attitude. They were known for their bad attitude. They were one of those people that were just miserable to be around. And they had this saying memorized, and boy, they had it down pat, and they'd say it all the time, "Well, I have to love them, but I don't have to like them." That doesn't sound very deep, a very deep love to me. Now, that doesn't mean that we like everything that people do. Does God like everything you do or I do? I don't believe that. But do you think that God doesn't want to be around us? You know, that's the implication of, I have to love them, but I don't have to like them. Oh, I have this theoretical love for them, yeah, but I don't want to be around them. If God had that attitude towards us, God has a perfect solution, doesn't he? He built a place for people that don't want to be around God and that God refuses to be around. And if God didn't like us, He has every right to send every one of us to that place, doesn't he? But God watched Jesus die to provide a way for us to be with him for eternity. I remember a fella back in the 70s, back when the hippies were still not mainstream, and his hair was too long and his clothes were too wild, and he'd stand up and he'd go, "You know, you straight-laced folks, you better learn to get on with me, because when we get to heaven, I'm going to move in next door for the first 100,000 years or so." And he goes, "And you know what that means, because when a hippie moves into the neighborhood, it just destroys the property value." The NASB, New American Standard, translates that word deeply this way. It translates it fervently. With fervor. Love one another with fervor. Look at what Peter wrote earlier. Look with me at 1 Peter 1:22. Look at 1 Peter 1:22. Peter links this love very clearly to salvation. And in Peter's day, it was easy because the unsaved hated the church. You know, it's a lot like today, isn't it? Well, you know, I think God's wonderful, but I can't stand those Christians. Mark it down. Mark it down. Here's what Peter says. Look at what he says. 1 Peter 1:21. Now that you have purified yourselves by obeying the truth. What a way to describe salvation. You have purified yourselves by obeying the truth so that you have sincere love for your brothers. Love one another deeply from the heart. Romans says it this way. Notice how Romans says it. Romans chapter 12, verse 10. Romans chapter 12, verse 10. Romans 12, 10. Notice how Paul says it. In Romans 12, 10, here's what he says. He says, love, Romans 12, 10, be devoted, what a word. Remember Acts chapter 2, verse 42, they devoted themselves. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. The word devoted imply? Why is it that we would have to be devoted to one another in brotherly love? Because you know what? Some of us are hard to love. And maybe it's more than some of us. Amen? And you know, it would be really easy to say something like this, you know? Well, I tried. They just don't want to be loved. And you know what? That's what the world does, doesn't it? The world at its best, it gives you a shot. If you blow it, they walk away. God's people are supposed to be different. Be devoted. In fact, Paul goes this far. Look with me at Romans. Before we run away from Romans, look at Romans 13. Romans chapter 13, verse 8. Look at how Paul describes it in Romans chapter 13, verse 8. He says, let no debt remain outstanding. Don't be a moocher. Pay your bill. Does that mean I can't have a mortgage? No. As long as you're paying that payment on time, do you owe anyone anything? No. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. He says, love is a debt we owe. Why do I owe a debt to love? Why is it an obligation? If I owe you $1,000 and I come to start making the payments and I pay that $50 and I pay, here's $50 on my $1,000 debt. And I walk away and go, they didn't even say thank you that I gave them that money. You have to thank me for repaying my debt? No, I owe it. It's an obligation. And Paul, writing to the church at Rome, says love is an obligation. It's not a gift I give to you. It's something I owe you. Why on earth would I owe you an obligation of love? And here's why. Now, this is only true for believers. It's not true for the world. It's only true for those that truly know Christ. The reason I owe a debt is because God's already obligated me to Him by taking the far more enormous debt I owed to Him and laying it on Jesus' back. Look at what Jesus says in John 13:35. Look at what Jesus says in John 13:35. Jesus says these words. And you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of reasons that people go to churches today. Oh, it's got great programs. Who cares? Oh, it's got 100 ministries. So what? Look at John 13:35. Here's what Jesus says, John 13:35. He starts in 34 when he says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another." By this. By what? When believers love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciple, if you love one another. Now, let me ask you a serious question. Here it is. How did the early Christians win the world? Think about this. In 40 years, from AD 30 when Jesus died to AD 70, the church went from 120 believers. Remember Acts 1? There were 120 believers in that upper room. That was the whole extent of the church on earth when Pentecost dawned that morning. How did that church of 120 individuals, and let's be honest, have you read the gospel? We're not talking the brightest bulbs in the box. We are not talking the most colorful crayons here. These guys were people just like us. They were flawed. You wanna plead flaws? Man, read the gospel. They were self-centered. They were arrogant. Remember John? We saw this guy preaching about you, and since he isn't like us, we told him to shut up and get out of the business. They were self-centered. Remember, Jesus is preparing for the most traumatic event in human history. The God-man, God but in human form, is going to die for sin. And you know what the only thing they can focus on the entire evening? Who's going to be the greatest? I want the right hand, Jesus. All right, I'll take the left hand, but the rest of you guys are out. No round table here. And then there's Peter. When I was a new Christian, and you know, even still today, but especially when I was a new Christian, I loved that Peter was an apostle. Because, man, Peter had the same affliction that I've had much of my life, hoof and mouth disease. And with Peter, it was never, would he put his foot in his mouth? It was, how would he shove the other one in there beside it? And they were so faithful. Remember the cross? They were all lined up there. God had 120 of those on the whole earth, and yet in 40 years, 40 years, the gospel had spread across the entire known world. It had gone all the way to Spain. It had gone all the way to India. It had gone up into Asia. It had gone down into Africa. How on earth? There was a historian that wrote a book just in recent years, and he said the whole reason that Christianity spread was because the Christians loved one another. There were three great plagues in the Roman Empire where the plague swept through the entire empire. And thousands upon thousands of people died. Millions. A huge percentage of the population. They had no antibiotics. They had no hospitals. They had no IVs. They had none of that stuff. If you got the plague, you died. And you know what the Romans did? For all their pagan worship and their rituals and their temples and their gods and goddesses, when the plague came, they fled. They left the cities and fled away to their country estates, hoping to live. You know who stayed behind? Christians. Because they wouldn't leave one another. They wouldn't leave one another. And in those days, I was just reading an article this morning that three of the greatest periods of the growth of Christianity in the history of the Roman Empire were the three greatest plagues. During that time, hundreds and hundreds of thousands were swept into the kingdom because they saw the difference between believers and non-believers and how they treated one another. They didn't have any money. Look at what 1 Corinthians, how Paul describes the church of his day. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26. And you know, so often we hear people say, oh, if we just had this resource, or if we just had this money, or if we just had more of these things. Notice what Paul says. He says, brothers, 1 Corinthians 1:26, brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. You didn't have PhDs and MITs and DDYs and who knows what else. Not many of you were influential. You know, one of the things they say about church growth today is you've got to find influential people, the right people to get to come to your church. I know pastors that brag about the influential people they have and how they're supporting this and how they're making it possible. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose. What a phrase. Not you chose, not I chose. God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of the world and to despise things and the things that are not, to nullify the things that are, so that no one can boast. I want you to think about the last 40 years. Has the church triumphed in America the way the church triumphed in the Roman Empire? In the last 40 years, have we gone from 120 to a church that spans the world? Or have we gone in the opposite direction? Is it because we lack money? Is it because we lack influence? We don't have enough senators, or we don't have a president in the White House that respects the gospel, and we don't. But is that the problem? By this, all men will know that you're my disciples. One another. And then I want you to notice the last thing that Peter says. And this is very interesting because, you know, we ought to take very seriously this, because today we live not just in the church in at large, but in a church that struggles with sin. And I would like to even say that the church is struggling with sin, but it seems, and I'm not going to say that it is, but at least it seems like the church isn't even struggling with sin anymore in this land. It seems like it's run up the white flag and surrendered to it. He says, above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude. Love covers a multitude. Now, this is not the great cover-up. I'll keep your secret if you keep mine. Oh, the world, even the world gets sick of that, doesn't it? You remember a couple of years ago when the Penn State scandal came out? And the first thing was, well, that'll never touch Joe because Joe's so loved. Why? He was Mr. Penn State for how many decades? How would you like to have Joe Paterno's biography? 40 years on a pedestal. And now how long will he have to live in infamy? As the man who turned a blind eye. This is not a cover-up. What then does Peter say? Why does he say love covers a multitude of sins? Well, there are several explanations. The first is the explanation that Paul gives in 1 Corinthians 13, where he says, if I were to, and he starts to list things that none of us will ever do, if I gave everything I had to feed the poor, you don't have love. If I had my body set on fire, if I had such knowledge that, you know, you come to me and I go, oh, that verse, well, here's exactly what it means. If I had divine knowledge of every single thing that God had ever said. He lists all these things. And then he says what? But if I don't have love, what's all that other stuff? Nothing. Remember what Jesus told the Pharisees? They were bragging about their tithing, and they were bragging about their praying, and they were bragging about, and he said, but you overlook the, what was the phrase he used? The weightier matters of the law. The prophet said it this way, you worship me with your, but not with your, see, the first reason that he says love covers a multitude of sins is because if love is present, then it's possible to deal with every other sin, isn't it? If there's a marriage and the people are devoted to loving one another, is there any problem they cannot overcome? On the other hand, if love isn't there, any excuse will do, isn't it? There is no relationship that love will not eventually win through if love is devoted to. If we don't really love one another, we'll always find an excuse. You know what? All of us are the kind of people that at sooner or later, at one point or another, deserve to have the cord cut, aren't we? Is there any one of us here that doesn't at some point do something that makes it very easy for someone to walk away? No, love doesn't do that, does it? I remember a TV show, and you know, even once in a while, I heard later that this person either was a Christian at the time or became a Christian after that. At least made a profession of faith. Who knows, you know, with Hollywood's filters, what's true and what's not. That person says, I choose not to exploit the days of weakness. People that I choose to do in the days of their weakness what will help to make them strong. Is there any one of us here that cannot be exploited on our day of weakness? Anyone here happy to be judged by your day of weakness? By things you've said in a moment of weakness? By things you've done in an hour of weakness. You know, love doesn't just count the hours of weakness, does it? That's why, notice what Ephesians, how Ephesians says it. Look with me at Ephesians. Oh boy, it's time to end. Look with me at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 2. Ephesians 4, verse 2. Here's what Ephesians 4, verse 2 says. It says, be completely humble and gentle. And boy, we could spend some time talking about that. And then it says these words. It says, be patient, bearing with one another in love. God says you're going to need to bear with one another because most of us are unbearable at some point in our lives or another. But love bears with. Love bears with. I want to end. I want to end with a story. We're going to sing a song. Close. It was written in 1772 or early 1773. I don't know the exact date. It was written by a man named John Fawcett. He was born January 6, 1739, in the days of the great Wesleyan revivals in England, a day when God was moving. In 1762, Fawcett joined the Methodists. But 3 years later, he united with the Baptist Church, and he became the pastor at Waynesgate Baptist Church in Hebden Bridge, West Yorkshire, England. He served there for 7 years, despite the fact that it was a very small congregation. They gave him a scant income, and he had a growing family. It seemed only practical. And how many times in the Christian life have you heard that word practical? Well, you know, it just makes sense. It seemed practical that he moved to a church that paid a larger salary. And so in 1772, when he received a call to the very large and influential Carter's Lane Baptist Church in London, planned to accept the call, and in fact he even sent and said that he would accept the call to go to Carter's Lane Baptist Church. But at the last minute, he changed his mind and he couldn't leave. His salary was only £25 a year. Now that, we may not know what's that, but it was a very meager salary in those days. To commemorate this event, he later wrote the words to this song that we're about to sing, the most famous hymn he ever penned. 5 years later, a new chapel was built for him at Hebden Bridge. They even opened a school. In 1793, he was invited to become the president of the Baptist Academy in England. But he declined because he couldn't leave the church. The song he wrote was Prestige. Here's my question. In the 1700s, the gospel exploded across England and the United States. It's what's called the First Great Awakening. When men of God like this had that attitude that it's not about career advancement, blessed be the tie that binds. If you love one another, all men will know you're my disciples. What is it that we're looking for? What is it that we're offering? You know, somebody says, I was talking to somebody and they go, well, it doesn't really matter if I go to church or not. My attitude is, if you have so little love for God's people that you don't even want to spend an hour a week with them, what does that say?